Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 210 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us and keep this thing going, please go to caropop.com and throw something in the kitty. Our guest this week is a distinctive guitarist who elevates many artists' works, including his own, Mark Rebo. I first noticed him on Tom Waits' Rain Dogs. What was that slinky, spiky guitar sound, and who was playing it? Rain Dogs was a professional breakthrough for Rebo, and his collaborations with Waits continued for several more albums, including Frank's Wild Years, Mule Variations, and Waits' most recent studio album, 2011's Bad As Me. But before then, Rebo had been playing for a while already. He was a member of the Lounge Lizards with John Lurie, had played soul jazz in Brother Jack McDuff's band, and had backed Chuck Berry, Wilson Pickett, Solomon Burke, and many others. Rebo would go on to tour and record with Elvis Costello on Spike, Mighty Like a Rose, and Kojak Variety. He also played on Robert Plant and Alison Krauss's Raising Sand, Elton John and Leon Russell's The Union, and albums by previous Carol Pop guest Sam Phillips, Yoko Ono, Diana Krall, John Zorn, and many more. Did Rebo initially set out to be a studio musician? Was he intimidated to meet or play with anyone? How much creative leeway did Waits, Costello, and others give him? What impact did producers such as T-Bone Burnett and Hal Wilner have on his work? Rebo also traces the strong influence of Latin American music on his playing. He relates being a left-handed person who learned to play guitar right-handed. He recalls the instrument he learned before guitar and how he was enlisted to play it on stage many years after he put it down. And he discusses the very long gestation period for his 2025 album, Map of a Blue City, his first album featuring his lead vocals, released at age 71.
It's not a blue map. It only looks that way. It's the map of a blue city.
Also, as a steering committee member of the Music Workers Alliance, the outspoken Rebo is at the forefront of the battle for indie musicians' rights. He digs into economic, copyright, AI, and other issues that, in his view, require urgent action. I saw Rebo perform solo at the Evanston Folk Festival last September, and it was a treat to hear up close so many aspects of his musicianship and personality. Learn even more here. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Mark Rebo. So I met you at the Evanston Folk Festival in September, and I'd seen you around there, and I was like, oh, you know, like you're someone who's playing, I've just enjoyed in so many different contexts, but I hadn't seen you play your own song solo and singing and all of that. How new was that for you?
Very. I mean, I've always done a few of my tunes off, or often done a few of my tunes with Ceramic Dog or other bands I've been in. It's not the first time I ever sang, or what I call singing anyways, but it's the first time I certainly tried to do it all, you know, a full set of vocal material. That's that was a challenge, to suddenly discover myself as a sensitive white male singer-songwriter at this stage in the game.
And with no you know, backing band. I mean, it's just you on the stage.
Just me.
Your voice and your guitar.
Well,
or whatever you want. Yeah.
Luckily, I had three of them. I had a guitar, a requinto, and I usually borrow an electric guitar just in case the singer songwriter thing becomes too painful.
How many shows did you do?
A lot. I toured. I say we because my manager Mary luckily drove me. She came with me on these tours, which made it great because she's a very good driver, and I'm a good driver too when I'm awake. I'm even a pretty good driver when I'm asleep, but not that good. So it's much better for everyone's health if she comes on the tours. So how many dates? I don't know. It was probably 45, 50. Not all that many, but we toured in the U.S. and in Europe.
Doing 45 to 50 dates when you haven't toured solo before ever after so many years in the business, that seems like a lot. That seems pretty ambitious.
Well, I'm an ambitious kind of guy.
There you go. Would you do it again?
Yes, certainly. In fact, I have a solo tour coming up, and it's interesting because usually on my solo tours, on a good night, I don't even talk. So it's all purely the sound of, and I just would bring that one acoustic guitar. So I don't know what I'm going to do on this solo tour. I'm going to try to get back into that, but I may, well, we'll see, you know.
It's an interesting move, as someone who's, I mean, what, just been on hundreds and hundreds of records and worked with so many different artists at this stage to be like, okay, here's the guy, here's me and my songs, and I'm not sort of counterpunching, I'm just sort of laying it all out there.
Right. Well, you know, side musicians are best heard but not heard. Sorry, that was a little convoluted. But
I understand
yeah.
it
But I mean,
completely.
I've been putting out my own records, whether they're
Right.
vocal or not, for quite some time. I mean, I think the first one came out in 79 or 80. So I'm not new to the idea of putting out my own material.
It's more the singing and the lyrics part of it, right?
Yeah, it's more of the lyrics part of it. But I had these tunes that were, I have these tunes that have been sitting around, some of them for decades, and I said, okay, time to get them out there, you know? And
Yeah.
that's what that record is, Map of a Blue City.
Right, yeah, New West put it out last year, but it had been gestating for many years. You worked with Hal Wilner on it. This year finally decided I'm just going to come up with this kind of spare version of it that makes it work. And
Yeah.
you got it out into the world.
I did. Yeah, no, it was a kind of a crazy process because, a few times over the last 25 years, I've thought, okay, I should put this stuff out. And well, the first time I phoned friends over at Epitaph that who I knew through Tom Waits, my friend over there, I sent him. At the time, people were still mail. This was in the 90s. People were still mailing CDs and stuff. So I sent him a CD of the tunes, and I waited a decent interval. So I called him and I said, "What do you think?" And he's, "Oh, we re did you get it?" And he said, "Yeah, oh yeah, we got it. Did you like it?" "Oh yes, we liked it. We liked it, Mark." And then, "Well, are you going to put out a record? Are you going to put it out on Epitaph?" "Well, Mark, we thought it was a little too dark for Epitaph."
Right. Which is a great album title right there.
Yes, I know for a while that's what the project was known, Too Dark for Epitaph, I was calling it that, but eventually cooler heads prevailed and came out as Map of a Blue City.
Right. Which I read an interview with you, and there's a pretty delightful story behind that title as well.
Yeah. My daughter, when she was about 7, went through this amazing period in which she was into urban design, and all she wanted to draw was maps of cities. She would draw these detailed maps with the pet store and the child-friendly restaurant and the library, and she knew who lived in every ha apartment, in the apartment buildings, and she knew what their pets were named. It was very detailed. And one day I saw she'd drawn one of these really detailed maps all in blue, a blue magic marker. And I said, "So how come you drew a blue map?" And she said, she looked at me as I was, as if I was an idiot, and said, "Because it's a map of a blue city, obviously, Dad." And I thought, okay,
That's one
that's
of those
good.
phrases you have to keep.
Yep, and I kept it.
Did you write the song then and there, or was it sort of years later you sort of looked and you said, oh, I have this title, this needs a song?
No, I wrote it soon after. I thought it kind of grew, the song grew out of the title.
Nice. So the first I heard of you was on Rain Dogs, the Tom Waits album, and it might have specifically been, I don't even know if I heard that album immediately when it came out. I think the first I heard was Jockey Full of Bourbon on the opening credits of Down by Law, and I was like, what is this cool guitar sound? And then I went and got Rain Dogs and thought the whole album was awesome, and looked up to see who was playing all that guitar. And that was, I think, your first big kind of major label project.
Well, I had been on major label projects before. Let me think. I think I don't remember if that was my first major label recording, but it certainly was the first one that really took off, you know.
Yeah. Now, did Tom Waits hire you? No, what I'd read was that you'd played with, I think, the Lounge Lizards, and he joined you on stage and then asked you to be on it. So I don't know if
Something
that's
like
right
that,
or
yeah.
not, but if did he hire you because you had a certain guitar sound, or did he say, "Hey, I want you to do this guitar sound on my album," and then you adapted to that?
Well, you know, I wasn't by any means the only guitarist on Rain Dogs. Robert Quine played on it. Keith Richards played on
Right.
it.
Yeah, no, I know.
They sounded pretty good too, you know.
You got the best songs though.
Well,
There's
thank
some
you.
there are a lot of really good songs on there, but the
Yeah,
first
no, I.
four are you, so.
Well, you know, it was it worked out well because, you know, Tom was writing, you know, like a lot of that stuff was Caribbean influenced. Bomba Plena. I mean, if you really come down to what is Jockey Full of Bourbon, what is that chord thing, that beat? It's called a plena in Puerto Rican music. It's party, Puerto Rican party music, you know? And so at the time, I had been interested. Well, you know, a lot of my neighbors, I was living in downtown New York, and a lot of my neighbors were from Latin America. So I'd been interested in what was coming through the walls and what was like at the block parties, you know. And so I'd done some listening to, you know, salsa and son, and to some extent plena and bomba. So I was interested in that, and I was also like the other stuff on that. I'd always been a fan of Duane Eddy, the late great Duane Eddy.
Sure.
You know, so like playing a lot of stuff on the bass notes kind of appealed to me. And also, like most rock guitar playing is blues based, you know, comes off blues scales. But I had been listening to a lot of Django Reinhardt, which is, it's a different kind of thing. Instead of going this pentatonic scale, there's a lot of outlining of the chords. It's a kind of, it's a pre-bebop approach to
Huh.
improvising, but it can, well, I like it, you know. So I was listening to a lot of Django, and so I was able to plug in on that, on those tunes. So there you go.
So did he hire you because he knew you could do that sort of thing, or
I
did you
don't
just
think
is that just
so.
what you brought to it and he was like, "Oh, that's cool."
Yeah, I think that was it. Although who knows? You have to ask Tom. But you know what it was he was in New, he'd come to New York at the time. I mean, he moved to New York in order to check out, you know, downtown music. Like this was 84, you know, 1983, 84. There was a lot going on. You know, the no wave stuff was going on. Lounge Lizards, well, a whole bunch of bands. DNA, the James Chance, you know, and a lot of great jazz musicians were playing as well. James Blood Ulmer, you know, Ornette's Primetime Band was coming out. And some of these were like, now it seems all very separated, but a lot of these, you know, James, I heard James Blood Ulmer play at Danceteria, you know. So there was a lot of knitting going on, as opposed to this kind of centrifugal separation.
So, and when you're working with Tom Waits, he's not saying, "Hey, this is the guitar part I want you to play." Does he just play
No,
you the
no, no.
song and then you just sort of do something and he says, "I like it or I don't like it"?
Yeah, basically, you know, he works dramatically. In other words, does this character fit in this play? You know, who's the singer in this? Where is the singer located? And what kind of band would be playing in that bar? You know,
Right.
is the bar in Shanghai? You know, is it just like, is it in Havana? Is it in New York? You know, what part of New York? So, you know, who's the singer? Is he old, young? You know,
So he's
so.
kind of visualizing this as the sort of soundtrack to this movie in his head.
Yeah, but he also works from groove. Like oftentimes, almost always, Tom would start start a rendition. It's not like we would read a description and then play. He would start playing guitar or congas or something, or rocking his body in a certain way, and that would cue us where the groove was. And he would let us know if it wasn't working, but he was very cool about it. He still is, you know. He doesn't say, play this, but, you know, but if it's not working, you know, he'll suggest you try something else. Or let's put it this way, you know, you should try something else.
Yeah. And
but he doesn't say play blah, 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 blah. No.
And you've been on all of his albums since then, right? I mean, he hasn't done one in a long
time.
No,
by no means.
Okay. You've been on a lot of them since then.
I've been on a bunch of them, yeah.
And did his working method change over that time, or was it still?
Well, it's been a little while since I actually, the last record that I played on with Tom, I mean, I haven't really been in the studio recording stuff with a band with Tom in quite some time.
Right.
You know, Frank's Wild Years and a bunch of the others were me overdubbing on tracks that he'd recorded with the rhythm section. Because Frank's Wild Years was based on a play that, you know, he had done in Chicago.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it Steppenwolf here?
Yeah.
I remember that.
Exactly. Steppenwolf Theater did it. And I couldn't make the whole run, so I didn't do the play. But my friends, you know, Greg Cohen and Ralph Carney did. And I think Michael Blair. So most of the band from Rain Dogs did make the gig, but I overdubbed all that stuff in one day.
So that's a different process from being in the room with him and you guys all figuring it out at the same
time.
Well,
I was still in the room with him, but not with Greg and Ralph, you know, and Michael, or not with the band.
Right. It's still well before the days when people were emailing each other their parts or something.
Well, you know, I mean, no, people were doing that then. You know, it was, you could transmit a multi-track recording, I think, online. It just took a long time, but people did it. So it was easy to overdub on tracks, and I did a lot of it. And I like it. It's a project. It's a process that I really enjoy. But there's something special about being in the room with the band too.
When
last time I was in the same room with Tom, from scratch was in my own record. Tom did Bella Chow, so we did that duo. I just went over to he has a studio. I think it's top secret where. So,
So you could tell us.
He'll have to torture me. but he has a studio in which he basically, it's an amazing place. He just bought this antique store, and I don't think he moved anything. He saw all it, or a lot. He cleared out some space, but a lot of it's just there. All these weird antiques, and there's no, like in studios, there's usually a lot of like very high tech sound baffling, you know, double glass doors or triple glass doors, and none of that. You just, you know, he just, if he didn't want two things to be together, he'd put them in different corners of the house, you know?
Right.
He'd just put them in different rooms far away. But it's, other than that, it's just like a normal house, you know, with a lot of recording gear in it.
So he hasn't said to you recently, hey, I'm gonna get back and do another album with you. And
well, Tom knows that if Tom knows my number. I have huge admiration for him. And if he wants to jam, I'm there.
Well, we'll all listen for it if he does. So, if you guys do, when you started out, first of all, you learned trumpet first, right?
Yes, that's right. You know,
and it's interesting because I was going back to some of, you know, the various records I have that you were on, like Elvis Costello's Spike and Mighty Like a Rose, and you're playing like cornet and horns on Mighty
Like a Rose. That's also Waits's fault, because that tour, you know, like I quit playing trumpet, you know, in like the 1960s, okay? I picked up guitar and I...
It's like when you got braces, right?
Yeah, I got braces and that was it for the trumpet. And also, you know, like I was listening to Keith Richards and somehow, you know... Well, I've told this story before too, but I had a, you know, classical trumpet teacher, you know, Salvatore Grimaldi. He was great, very nice man. But, you know, I was a kid. What did I know? So one day I brought in, I knew that my friend's older brother was cool and he listened to Miles Davis records. So I brought in a Miles Davis record. I said, Mr. Grimaldi, I want you to teach me to play like that. And so he put this piece of music, I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts, on the music stand.
Right.
And he just said, you do these things, ornamentation. Do you do 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 you do do you do do, you know, like these like little slurs and things around the notes. And that's all it is. And I somehow I knew Mr. Grimaldi was never going to teach me to sound like Miles Davis. So that plus the braces kind of, and plus that I was like listening to Keith Richards like play guitar and going, yeah, you know. So like that did it for trumpet, and nothing happened for the ensuing 25 years on trumpet. It was in the, I don't even think I kept one.
You weren't like playing it on the side just to keep in shape or anything.
No, I wasn't in shape at all. I hadn't played it, but we were rehearsing for the Rain Dogs tour, and I made the mistake of saying, oh, yeah, I used to play trumpet. And the next day, there was a trumpet there. And the next week, I was playing in front of 3,000 people in Scotland, you know.
Well, I hope it came back pretty fast for you.
No, but, you know, luckily, I was just doing sectional stuff. I wasn't soloing. Ralph Carney could carry it for both of us. So I was playing along with Ralph Sax. So people didn't notice me that well.
So when you're doing Mighty Like a Rose, they're like, oh, we know that you're an accomplished horn player, so you need to get on trumpet and cornet or whatever else you were playing on that?
I don't remember why. I don't think they call me because they want an accomplished trumpet cornet player. I think they have other people who, if Elvis wanted.
I mean, you play a lot of guitar on that record, obviously, but but it was interesting that you're also doing that.
Right, but I think Elvis has like a certain fondness for, you know, has this in common with Tom. He has a certain fondness for Salvation Army bands, you know.
Right.
That's kind of my sound.
That is the sound on those songs on Mighty Like a Rose also.
There you go.
Couldn't Call It Unexpected 4, I think, is one of them. Last song on the record. So to backtrack, so then you learn guitar, you listen to Keith Richards, And was there something where you were like left-handed learning right-handed or something like that?
I'm actually, when I write, I use my left hand. Although on the rare occasions I throw a baseball, I do it with my right hand. Anyways, so I was taught to play guitar right-handed, the normal stringing and posture. And about 3 years into it, I realized that, why am I doing this? You know, I'm left-handed. So I asked my teacher, Franz Caseus, and he said, well, it was your mother's idea. She said you're not really right-handed and you're just pretending you are to annoy her. And then I asked my mother and she said, no, that's not true at all. It was Franz's thing. He said, the kid'll probably, he was just too lazy to restring my guitar. He said, the kid will quit in 3 weeks anyways. Why bother? And I think they were probably both telling the truth, you know, sadly.
So how did that influence how you play guitar?
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, I would have said that it slowed me down quite a bit, which turned out to be a good thing because it forced me, you know, it was clear from the outset that I wasn't going to be Joe Pass, you know, but I studied Chuck Berry, for that matter, not Django Reinhardt either, you know, who's seriously virtuosic. But I studied people who use a lot of economy in their playing, like B.B. King and Chuck Berry and Keith Richards, you know, people who use a lot of economy and got a lot of mileage for a few notes. And I think that was a good study, how to use space, you know. So I think it influenced me that way. But nowadays, I don't have that excuse anymore since Mary Halverson told me that she's also left-handed and plays right-handed, and she can play circles around me. So nowadays, I just try not to say anything.
Have you picked up a left-handed guitar and tried playing it the other way?
Yes, I did when I was like about 18. And I'm telling you something, I was, you know, I wasn't a little kid, but I was in tears. It was absolutely one of the most terrifying things of my life. It's as if, you know, you tried to walk and your hands moved. It was a nightmare.
Like it didn't work well.
It didn't work at all.
Because you just had trained your brain to do it the
I
other
was
way.
back to less than square one, and it was so painful. Because
When you were.
basically, it's the only thing I can do. In to quote Melanie, it's the only thing I can do half right.
When you were learning guitar, what did you have visions of doing with it? Did you think, I'm going to be a rock star, a jazz virtuoso?
You know, it's funny. When I first started, when I first started playing guitar, I just thought, well, cool, I'll sit in the stairwell and play guitar, and maybe a girl will like me, of my high school, and maybe a girl will like me. And then I played, with the same, something like the same motivation. I started playing high school dances with my high school bands. The first one was Love Gun, and the second one was already, I was already in like the late 60s into retro. Was the Milburn, New Jersey Grease Band, which played a mixture of, 1950s doo-wop and hits and MC5 covers about fighting the police. It was an interesting band.
Wow.
My motivations were cool. I'll get to play at this party, I didn't think much about it. My parents, I remember they summoned me for a serious talk, and they said, Mark, it's very nice that you're playing it, in these bands and all this during high school and junior high, but we hope you're mature enough to understand that this is not a living. And I s shook my head. Oh, don't worry, I understand it, because I had much more mature plans. I was going to go to South America and become a revolutionary like Che Guevara. But that didn't work out either, so I wound up being a musician.
Did you try?
Well, not in South America.
I'm just going to leave that there so you can explain
Yeah.
that.
I think I'd rather not explain it.
Okay. He was a revolutionary somewhere other than South America, so.
One would hope so.
Did you envision yourself as being the Keith Richards of some band, like, some Rolling Stones like band that goes on for years and years, and you're the featured guitarist?
Yeah, well, by the time I actually said, the South American revolutionary thing isn't working out, so I may as well try to do this thing that I once made money doing, playing bar bands and playing coffee houses and like that. I was living in Maine at the time. I had moved to Maine, and by that time, all I thought about was like, oh, this is cool. I can make $30 and pay my rent, $30 a night and pay my rent. There was a low rent there at the time in the 70s in Maine. And by the time I moved down to New York, all I knew is that I wanted to play guitar. I wasn't really ambitious. I wanted to have my hands on the guitar, learn how to play it really well. I think I wanted to be a studio musician, which also it worked out in a way, but not in the exact way I'd planned. I never made it as a one size fits all session guy, but
Well, you've
because
done a lot of sessions. I
I
mean,
have done a lot of sessions, but luckily, generally it's people who want what I do. So yes, I have done a lot of sessions. I've been very lucky.
but you saw yourself as a studio musician pretty much from the start.
I saw myself as somebody who wanted to play guitar, and I realized moving down to when I moved, and part of that, I guess, also was wanting some kind of freedom. When I lived in Maine, it seemed like jazz was the music of freedom, because we were playing in top 40 bands and you had to play all this crap, and those jazz people could play so much better. And, I thought, oh, wow. This is freedom. But then when I came down to New York, it had kind of, in a way, it had reversed. At least the entry level jazz gigs were very, I mean, they were it was very set, the repertoire. You had to learn this bebop repertoire. I was not, when I came to New York, I didn't rush right into the loft scene, you know. I was trying to play, not very successfully, mainstream, you know, which was kind of the language that young musicians, a lot of young musicians, regardless of what they wound up playing, would use to meet each other, you know, at jam sessions, or, you know, you could say, it was a way of saying I can play. That's all I knew, is that I wanted to play. And later on, I started, like I said, I started to realize that, you know, okay, there was a lot of freedom going on at CBGB's, you know,
right,
that these bands compositionally. And later on, when I, you know, when I heard other venues and no wave and loft jazz type stuff, I started understanding what was happening in New York in the 80s, you know, during the 80s, you know.
At what point were you playing with Brother Jack McDuff?
1979. He was probably my first recording artist that I worked with regularly. I didn't work with him for that long, 4 months, but I learned a lot.
And he's a guy who had the jazz background, but then had sort of moved more into this kind of soul jazz thing in the 70s.
Yeah. He was a soul jazz player, you know. I mean, people in his situation, I mean, he had a complex relation, you know. He would refer to bebop as starvation music. But at the same time, he loved it. You know, he admired, you know, Charlie Parker, Sonny Stitt. But I mean, he also was a big fan of Count Basie, you know, like for all that era of player, regardless of what they actually put out on the records, Count Basie was kind of the gold standard in terms of how you play the eighth note.
Huh.
Yeah.
When you were playing with Brother Jack McDuff, did that feel like a good fit for you musically? Or were you like, you know, I think I'm leaning a little more on the, you know, the rock side and maybe the edgy
I would have, you know, the guitarist, one of the guitarists, one of many guitarists who was in Brother Jack's band before me was George Benson. And I would have given my left foot to play like George Benson. I would still give a couple of toes, you know. I would have loved to. There's nothing I would have loved to have more than to have been a guitarist just touring on the Chitlin' circuit and playing funky jazz, you know, my whole life. But it was not a good fit, and it was not a good fit because basically, Brother Jack was pissed off at me. I mean, his gold standard was Count Basie, and there's a certain way of feeling time that is, well, I realized much later on that the reasons I felt it differently were much bigger than me. I think that something had changed between our generations, and there's a reason why, you know, I've said this often, but when you hear a jazz soloist, they sound like they have all the time in the world, even if all they're playing is 12 bars or 16 bars, you know, somebody's really from the tradition. When you hear a rock soloist, you know, like, I mean, starting very much with Ike Turner, they sound like they're, if they don't hurry up, they're going to die. You know, somebody's chasing them with a shotgun, even if they have 5 minutes, you know, so I could imitate the first, but I wasn't really feeling it.
You grew up in the second.
I grew up in the second. It's like, you know, I don't know what it was, nuclear bombs, you know.
There's kind of this urgency to, I mean, you know, the rock music you grew up with, and yeah, it's tight and urgent.
Yeah, well, not always tight, but urgent.
Yeah, right, exactly. were you generally happier on stage or in the studio?
Totally different things, and happy both, you know. If the music is going well, it's a lot of fun. It's more than fun. It's a reason to live, you know.
Were you spending most, because obviously you've done a lot of studio work. How were you dividing your time? Like, were you on the road for parts of the year and then just working in studios parts of the year? Like, how did that work?
Well, that's how it worked. I do my best to, but again, I've been very lucky. I've been very lucky in that I've been able to pick and choose more than a lot of people have, because, and I have generally not done, like, in a way, I've been lucky because I haven't had hit records. When you have hit records, if you're doing that thing, you go out and you tour for 2 years, And so, like, failure has been good to me. And when you come back from 2 years, nobody remembers that you were ever in town. It takes 2 years to for people to remember that you exist. So a lot of people get stuck. They go out on the road, they come back, they spend the money, they spend their bread, and then the only thing left is to take another tour, because they're not in the local scene, they don't have their own band. I did it a little bit differently. I had my own projects, and I mean, at the beginning, it seemed like a limitation, but when I was in my early 40s, I had my daughter. And, so I made a decision that I wasn't going to go on long tours. I was going to max 2 weeks. And that meant there was a lot of gigs that I couldn't do. I mean, I didn't do the first, the Raising Sand tour, for example.
With
So,
Robert Plant and Alison
yeah,
Krauss.
with Robert Plant and Alison Krauss and T-Bone Burnett, as band leader. So I would have loved to have done that, but they were looking at really doing it 6 months, 8 months, I just couldn't commit to that.
Right. Well, yeah, I was going to backtrack. I don't think anyone would characterize what you've been doing as failure. I think it would just be it's, because you're not a hit singles guy. It's just not what you do, but what you've done. I mean, you've worked with, I mean, again, you've worked with Robert Plant and Alison Krauss and
I've been very happy about what
Sam
I've been able
Phillips. You're on those records,
to. Oh
which are
yeah,
terrific.
sounds so talented.
Elton John and Leon Russell, Diana Krall, Costello. I mean, I could just sort of list it all. Was that part of the attraction for you to just work with different artists and sort of, I don't know, get into their DNA a little bit and have some of it rub off on you?
I mean, all the people you mentioned and most of the people I've been able to work with have something that they do that's amazing, And so I was honored to get called,
So what was Costello like? And again, you're telling me how Tom Waits is, he's sort of playing the stuff for you, giving you the setting, sort of giving you this freedom. Is Costello like that, or is he more like, this is what the song is and this is what the part should do?
He also gave a lot, he was also very receptive to ideas, all band members' ideas. And that's a good thing because the attractions, I mean, Steve Naive has brilliant ideas in the studio, and Pete Thomas,
Sure.
great, great drummer. So yeah, he was very open to other people's ideas. What one thing about Elvis is he's an excellent guitarist himself, and not maybe in the sense like he's not going to take over the Segovia title, but in the sense of an excellent studio guitarist, he can come up with sounds, really interesting sounds, and the parts that fit. I mean, recording. The art of recording, it's kind of like making a sandwich. It's not just, oh, I have this brilliant part, but the each layer of sound has to fit with the other layers. If it's stepping on the other layers, then you get a acoustical phenomenon known as cancellation. When two instruments play the same note, it cancels the note. Right. Strange, but true. So, you know, the whole thing about having getting the timbre of the instrument, the right part, the right pitch for the part, you know, that's what it's about. And Elvis happens to be really good at that.
So would you have to find a way to fit in with what he was already playing then? I mean, because he would be the guitarist in the attractions and would call himself what, like Little Fingers of Concrete or whatever. Right. But he always had this kind of jabby sounds going on.
Yeah.
But he didn't tend to have like a lead guitarist on those attractions albums. And then he made Spike, Mighty Like a Rose, where he's put aside the attractions.
Well, I have to say, Allison and watching the detectives, I don't know if he didn't play the part, but the part on Allison, I'm trying to remember who played that, but it's
the guy from Clover, probably.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant studio guitarist.
Yeah, no, there are some good leads on those. But in general, he wasn't known for having a lead guitarist until, like, when I saw him perform live with you, it was, like, one of the few times. And then, recently he's doing it with Charlie Sexton, who still doesn't do all that much on there. But it was, like, a lead guitar part as opposed to his kind of, like, little jabby things was sort of new for that sound for him.
Yeah.
And that was you.
Well, it was, that's my job.
So again, were you coming up with parts, sort of working around what he was already doing on the guitar and everything else?
Yeah, usually we develop the. I mean, if we were covering things from his repertoire, then I was expected to learn the part from the record.
Sure.
If we were doing new things in the studio, then yes, we would invent parts, try them out, see what flew, listen back, change, replace. Perfect, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there are songs like "Let 'Em Dangle," which is a pretty straightforward song, and you're kind of, you know, again, putting the sort of ominous notes in there about, and then there's something like "Hurry Down Doomsday, the Bugs Are Taking Over," which is just kind of a nuts song, and everyone's kind of, you know, Jim Keltner's kind of going crazy and gets the songwriting credit on it. That might be as musically as close to Tom Waits as Elvis Costello got, but you know, any thoughts of, I don't know, recording those pieces?
It was a long time ago, brother, you know, it was many miles and many years ago. So I remember we had a good time and that was it.
How important was sort of working with producers you were familiar with? Like, you did a lot with T-Bone Burnett, whether it was Costello or Sam Phillips or Elton John and Leon Russell.
I've been very lucky to work with some great producers. And T-Bone is definitely really an amazing producer. To work with, you know, I was telling you that I did a lot of overdubbing sessions on records, including some of the ones that he played on. So if I wasn't on the basic tracks, I would just come in and overdub. But he would leave me there with, you know, at the time it was analog tape, 24 track, but there would be more than one connected together. So 48 tracks, you know, anyways, a lot of tracks. And I would just experiment, you know, try a lot of different ideas. And T-Bone's brilliance is that he could come in at the end of the day, make a cup, listen for 10 seconds to each, or not even 5 seconds, and he'd know which were the tracks that were good. He would know. The other thing that is great about T-Bone is, you know, there's a lot of people who think, oh, we have to get it right. Oh, this was a mistake. T-Bone listens for one thing on the basic tracks. Does it rock or does it not rock? And he will always take the track that rocks. So if the first take rocks, we can have done 40 takes. Well, we never got that far, but we could have done 10 takes. He'll go back to the first one. And even in the days of analog tape, say, cut it up, fix it. You know, this is the one that has to be the one.
Right.
This is the one that rocks. So that's what a great producer does, is that they prioritize whatever it is that the thing needs.
Feel is more important than perfectionism, for sure.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, you can seek the perfectionism later. You know, you can go back with a lot of editing, and the poor engineers were doing a lot of erasing and over, you know, pasting and cutting and pasting. But yeah, so T-Bone was very good at hearing right away when something was working, and still is. And Hal Wilder, who I should also mention, was he was a very brilliant. He was great at casting. In addition to those other things, he would put very strange people in a room together and then see what happened. You know, he was also spend a lot of time going through the takes, seeing which ones worked, you know, making it sound good.
Did he ever put you in a situation where you were like, what is he doing?
Sure. You know, I mean, when we did the first this Allen Ginsberg record, you know, The Lion for Real, I didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, there was like four guitarists in there, me, Frizzell, Arto Lindsay, and oh, I'm forgetting, this is terrible, but great guy, great guitarist from New Orleans. You know, like what's his name? Gary Window, this out saxophone player. And it was a lot of very interesting people who would have never otherwise met, you know, people from the rock scene and people from the jazz scene.
So working with all those people came up with something that you wouldn't have expected, I assume.
Yeah, it did. You know, it did. I recommend the record very highly. It's recently been re-released. I don't know what the re-release title is, but Kramer from Shimmy Disc was involved in getting it re-released, and I'm very proud to have played on it.
Was there anyone you were ever intimidated to work with? Like whether it was one of the early guys like Chuck Berry or Wilson Pickett, or later, you know, Elton John or Robert Plant, Yoko?
Let me see. I don't think so, but I was, when I was very young, I think I was afraid of Brother Jack because he used to glare at me while we were on the bandstand. He would give me the death ray, you know, so that wasn't fun when I was 22, you know, but what didn't kill me made me stronger.
Any of the artists you worked with, do you feel like you absorbed certain lessons from them when it came to writing your own songs?
In terms of intimidation, I also have to add, Wilson Pickett was a scary guy.
How?
He would hit members of the band, and he had a bodyguard who was reportedly armed, so nobody wanted to hit back.
Did he hit you?
No, I saved myself with country western licks. I'd worked with Solomon Burke, who was his songwriting partner early on. And like, I was aware there was a serious country western connection, you know, that he was a big fan, you know. In a couple of difficult moments, I was able to calm Wilson down with country western licks.
Wow, that's the way you tame Wilson Pickett is.
Well, I wouldn't say I tamed him, but
calmed him down a little enough.
Enough.
Do you remember the first song you ever wrote?
Yeah, I do, actually. It's an instrumental that I never recorded, but who knows, maybe someday.
What's it called?
It doesn't have a name.
So you have an untitled instrumental lurking there.
Yeah, somewhere. Maybe someday.
And were there songwriters you've worked with that you feel like influenced your own songwriting particularly?
Well, probably all the people we've been talking about, but Daniel Johnston.
Okay.
Definitely. Who else? Yeah, to be sure. I like Serge Gainsbourg's lyrics. And Harry Partch. I loved Harry Partch's vocal music. You should check it out.
Oh, nice. I will. on a different topic, you've been doing a lot of work for artists' rights. And I'm curious what you think sort of the biggest threats are. I saw that you have a post about we need a union and a petition for that. So, like, tell me what you think the threats are and what the possible remedies are.
Well, We Need a Union is a campaign of an organization that I am on the steering committee of, Music Workers Alliance. And Music Workers Alliance and a whole bunch of other organizations sort of came to being in the last 20 years, 25 years, because, well, it's very clear that indie musicians, people who record primarily for indie labels, I mean, the AFM does a great job of the areas that it has had under contract. Major label, major Hollywood film, Broadway, symphonic. These are wonderful. You know, if you get those gigs, they're fantastic.
That's the American Federation of Musicians. The AFM.
That's right. That's right. American Federation of Musicians. But, and it's, they have not particularly represented indie musicians, which is not entirely their own fault. The indie label phenomena, contrary to popular belief, was not invented to make us freer and more creative. It was invented, it's a form of outsourcing. It began in the 70s. At the same time, industries across the board were outsourcing their production units. And the way it worked is the major labels, like Ford, you know, like General Motors, discovered that, you know, if they made stuff in-house, it was under union contract and expensive. But if they just distributed stuff that was made somewhere else, then they didn't have to pay. Then they could get it much cheaper, make the steady distribution money, and they wouldn't have to pay all these back-end residuals and all these other things that are owed under the union contracts. So that's why that switch happened. And like a tiny part of that, this was a switch that happened in every genre of music, not just the tiny part of indie rock that was known as true indie movement. And I realize that I'm like, what I'm saying is absolute blasphemy to a lot of people, but I'm sorry, it's the way it is. There's a large group of people since the corporations made this switch in the mid 70s. The result was a huge group of people, the majority of recording musicians, are not working under union contract. And the result of that has been that they get paid a lot less. And so it two results. One, they get paid a lot less. I mean, the average rate for a session musician now in New York is around $500 a day, which is kind of what it was in 1985 when my apartment was $250 a month.
Right.
In New York, okay. So things have not been going great for working musicians. The second result it had is that we've been subject, unions also have a political role. They hire legislative directors. They're part of the AFL-CIO, who has lobbyists in every state capital and in Washington. They try to prevent laws that have hurt us. And we have been really badly hurt by particular laws that have not protected us in the digital domain in particular. So,
is that in terms of like streaming and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know how into the weeds I should get, but everybody, for example, is mad about Spotify, and with good cause, because, you know, if it costs you $5,000, $10,000 to make a record, you're not going to make it back before you're old. Most bands won't make it back before they're very old off Spotify. But the reason Spotify sucks is not just because of Spotify. Spotify sucks because it's in competition with YouTube. And very simply put, we can't sell what anybody can get for free. It's not, you don't have to have a doctor in economics to know that. And There have been tens of millions of dollars pumped into on a regular basis to organizations telling us that things are better than ever. I'm sorry, the tech industry has protected itself very well. If you go to the Securities and Exchange Commission filing on liabilities for Alphabet, which is Google and YouTube's company, you'll see the first thing they say is we are dependent on Section 512 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act safe harbors. In other words, these safe harbors says they can't be sued, no matter how much of their business is based on selling ads or data mining of copyright infringing files. They can't be sued, no matter how bad the effect is. They can't be sued. Okay, so that there are these bedrock laws that are the cause of why things are screwed up. I don't think we're going to fix that, but there is something that we can anytime soon. I hope we can, but there is something that we can fix right now, and that's what We Need a Union came about. The major labels are in the process of negotiating licensing deals with the AI companies. And these are going to be harmful to musicians. They were saying, oh, don't worry, this will never wind up in competition with your own music if you license it to us. Because it'll be siloed in our own platform. Now they're saying something totally different. They're saying, well, there's going to be a paid a paid tier, and people from the paid tier will be able to monetize. Oh yeah, the other thing that they're saying, it don't worry with this, with this, that they will control it on their own platform. We heard this in 1997, 1998. The major labels had this thing, a technological tool that was supposed to block CDs and digital recordings from ever being uploaded or downloaded. Well, we know that didn't really work out very well.
Right.
And then in fact, everything is going to be available. If somebody thinks they can make money off something, it's going to be whatever controls are put in place are going to be hacked in about 5 minutes. The other thing is that they're saying, well, this is fair, this is equitable because the artists and songwriters are going to be given a right of consent, so they can say no. And that's very lovely. But what about non-featured artist band members? Not everybody signs the contract who played in the band. What about side musicians? What about DJ producers who got paid a bag of money, or not a bag, who got paid in cash for the session? There's a lot of people who are not going to be paid and basically are going to be in danger of being made unemployed by this. Now, we all know, nobody wants to be called a Luddite. Nobody wants to stand in the way of technology. Although I think the Luddites got some bad press. I want to be. I don't mind being called a Luddite.
There you go.
But well, there's a. I recommend Blood in the Machine, an excellent book on the Luddites, which evaluates them. But they. Sorry, I lost my train of thought with my own jokes, but suffice it to say that this is going to be very bad for musicians. We're getting in the streets, and we're going to make some noise about it. We're not going to see the dreams of young musicians crushed and our art form degraded, just so that these people can make a killing. Now, what I was going to say before is there are certain. There are certain parts of technology that cannot be stopped. I mean, we all feel bad for John Henry, who died with a hammer in his hand, right? But nobody's riding on the railroad, today thinking, oh, I wish there was a hand-driven spike beneath my wheels, right?
Right.
The movement to rehire John Henry's widow is not. To hand drive railroad spikes is not likely to succeed. But the thing is, this is not a machine that does our job. This is technology. Without our work, if our work is not ingested, it doesn't do anything. And it's a very simple principle. If our work is going to be used to generate billions of dollars for these companies, we deserve a fair share. And we deserve, and the only way to get that is by getting a right of consent, a right of to say no. If you can't say no, you don't get anything.
So it seems like there's like this. This is true in my profession too, of journalists, writers, and all of this.
Oh yes,
in that you're already in bad shape in terms of being exploited. And then just when you're sort of trying to figure out how to get up from that, you got AI coming in and people think, oh, you know what? I could just go into ChatGPT and say, hey, give me a guitar solo, kind of like that guy Mark does.
Exactly.
And so then what does that do? If someone could like punch in one of your guitar solos or have AI invent something that sounds like quote unquote you, then what the hell,
Well, that's a very good question. And you're absolutely right. This has definitely, see New York, that's the reason New York Times sued, which one was it, Affinity or another one of the big AI companies? And that is exactly what they said in their lawsuit. This is causing unemployment. And it's causing the unemployment of the people who did the work.
Right.
It's not the AI machine.
Whose work is being researched, processed. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, processed often terribly incorrectly, by the way, but
right.
that's another story. So what we need to do is, we need a union campaign, musicworkersalliance.com. We need to get all groups of musicians. We have a petition out. It can all be found out under the We Need a Union campaign at musicworkersalliance.org. And we need to get everybody to sign that petition.
So finally, do you have like another album's worth of material you're getting ready to go, or is it going to take a while again?
I'm working on other songs. I have a group that I've been touring with, a jazz ensemble that with Chad Taylor and Sebastian Steinberg, and I've been using different fourth people in the quartet. But it's called Hurry Red Telephone, which is a line from a poem by Richard Sykin. Anyways, so I'm touring with that, and we're hoping to record it soon. So always working on something.
So it's a set of songs you've written for this group?
Yeah.
Cool. You coming to Chicago anytime?
I hope so.
Thank you so much. It was really great talking with you. It was cool meeting you at the Folk Festival, too. I was like, I know that guy. And the performance was just different from what I expected because it just like had a lot going on. And anyway, I really appreciated it.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
That's it for episode 210 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Mark Rebo for providing so much insight into his collaborations, solo work, and activism. New West Records released his latest album, Map of a Blue City, last May. You could order it from New West's website, as well as Rebo's Bandcamp page, and his own website, markrebo.com. Remember, that's Mark with a C. You could find information about his upcoming shows there as well. He's on a solo tour of Europe through February 8th, and he'll be playing shows with the Mark Rebo Quartet on February 20th and 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Appleton, Wisconsin, respectively. He's got solo dates in March in the Southeast U.S. as well. Follow him on Instagram, Facebook, X, YouTube, and SoundCloud. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who only occasionally might be mistaken for a lounge lizard. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. I'll give you a shout-out on the next episode. Please go to carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and return next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.